Chapter 91. It was a dark night, though the full moon rose as I left the enclosed lands, and passed out upon the marshes. Beyond their dark line there was a ribbon of clear sky, hardly broad enough to hold the red large moon. In a few minutes she had ascended out of that clear field, in among the piled mountains of cloud. There was a melancholy wind, and the marshes were very dismal. A stranger would have found them insupportable, and even to me, they were so oppressive that I hesitated, half inclined to go back. But, I knew them well, and could have found my way on a far darker night, and had no excuse for returning, being there. So, having come there against my inclination, I went on against it. The direction that I took was not that in which my old home lay, nor that in which we had pursued the convicts. My back was turned towards the distant hulks as I walked on, and, though I could see the old lights away on the spits of sand, I saw them over my shoulder. I knew the Limicoln as well as I knew the old battery, but they were miles apart, so that if a light had been burning at each point that night, there would have been a long strip of the blank horizon between the two bright specks. At first, I had to shut some gates after me, and now and then to stand still, while the cattle, that were lying in the banked-up pathway, arose and blundered down among the grass and reeds. But after a little while, I seemed to have the whole flats to myself. It was another half hour before I drew near to the kiln. The lime was burning with a sluggish, stifling smell, but the fires were made up and left, and no workmen were visible. Hard by, was a small stone quarry. It lay directly in my way, and had been worked that day, as I saw by the tools, and barrows that were lying about. Coming up again to the marsh level out of this excavation for the rude path lay through it, I saw a light in the old sluice house. I quickened my pace, and knocked at the door with my hand. Waiting for some reply, I looked about me, noticing how the sluice was abandoned and broken, and how the house of wood with a tiled roof would not be proof against the weather much longer, if it were so even now, and how the mud and ooze were coated with lime, and how the choking vapor of the kiln crept in a ghostly way towards me. Still there was no answer, and I knocked again. No answer still, and I tried the latch. It rose under my hand, and the door yielded. Looking in, I saw a lighted candle on a table, a bench, and a mattress on a truckle bedstead. As there was a loft above, I called, "Is there anyone here?" But no voice answered. Then, I looked at my watch, and, finding that it was past 9, called again, "Is there anyone here?" There being still no answer, I went out at the door, irresolute what to do. It was beginning to rain fast. Seeing nothing save what I had seen already, I turned back into the house, and stood just within the shelter of the doorway, looking out into the night. While I was considering that someone must have been there lately, and must soon be coming back, or the candle would not be burning, it came into my head to look, if the wick were long. I turned round to do so, and had taken up the candle in my hand, when it was extinguished by some violent shock, and the next thing I comprehended was that I had been caught in a strong running noose, thrown over my head from behind. "Now," said a suppressed voice with an oath, "I've got you." "What is this?" I cried, struggling. "Who is it? Help, help, help." Not only were my arms pulled close to my sides, but the pressure on my bad arm caused me exquisite pain. Sometimes, a strong man's hand, sometimes a strong man's breast, was set against my mouth to deaden my cries, and with a hot breath always close to me, I struggled ineffectually in the dark, while I was fastened tight to the wall. "And now," said the suppressed voice with another oath, "call out again, and I'll make short work of you." Faint and sick with the pain of my injured arm, bewildered by the surprise, and yet conscious how easily this threat could be put in execution, I desisted, and tried to ease my arm were it ever so little. But, it was bound too tight for that. I felt as if, having been burnt before, it were now being boiled. The sudden exclusion of the night, and the substitution of black darkness in its place, warned me that the man had closed a shutter. After groping about for a little, he found the flint and steel he wanted, and began to strike a light. I strained my sight upon the sparks that fell among the tinder, and upon which he breathed and breathed, match in hand, but I could only see his lips, and the blue point of the match, even those, but fitfully. The tinder was damp, no wonder there, and one after another the sparks died out. The man was in no hurry, and struck again with the flint and steel. As the sparks fell thick and bright about him, I could see his hands, and touches of his face, and could make out that he was seated and bending over the table, but nothing more. Presently I saw his blue lips again, breathing on the tinder, and then a flare of light flashed up, and showed me Orlick. Whom I had looked for, I don't know. I had not looked for him. Seeing him, I felt that I was in a dangerous strait indeed, and I kept my eyes upon him. He lighted the candle from the flaring match with great deliberation, and dropped the match, and trotted out. Then, he put the candle away from him on the table, so that he could see me, and sat with his arms folded on the table and looked at me. I made out that I was fastened to a stout perpendicular ladder a few inches from the wall, a fixture there the means of ascent to the loft above. "Now," said he, when we had surveyed one another for some time, "I've got you. Unbind me. Let me go." "Ah," he returned, "I'll let you go. I'll let you go to the moon, I'll let you go to the stars. All in good time. Why have you lured me here?" "Don't you know?" said he, with a deadly look, "why have you set upon me in the dark?" "Because I mean to do it all myself. One keeps a secret better than two. Oh, you enemy, you enemy." His enjoyment of the spectacle I furnished, as he sat with his arms folded on the table, shaking his head at me and hugging himself, had a malignity in it that made me tremble. As I watched him in silence, he put his hand into the corner at his side, and took up a gun with a brass-bound stock. "Do you know this?" said he, making as if he would take aim at me. "Do you know where you saw it afore? Speak, Wolf." "Yes," I answered. "You cost me that place." "You did." "Speak. What else could I do?" "You did that, and that would be enough, without more. How dared you to come betwixt me, and a young woman I liked?" "When did I? When didn't you? It was you as always give old Orlick a bad name to her. You gave it to yourself. You gained it for yourself. I could have done you no harm, if you had done yourself none. You're a liar. And you'll take any pains, and spend any money, to drive me out of this country, will you?" said he, repeating my words to Biddy in the last interview I had with her. "Now, I'll tell you a piece of information. It was never so well worth your while to get me out of this country as it is tonight. Ah, if it was all your money 20 times told, to the last brass farden." As he shook his heavy hand at me, with his mouth snarling like a tiger's, I felt that it was true. "What are you going to do to me?" "I may going," said he, bringing his fist down upon the table with a heavy blow, and rising as the blow fell, to give it greater force, "I may going to have your life." He leaned forward staring at me, slowly unclenched his hand, and drew it across his mouth, as if his mouth watered for me, and sat down again. "You was always in old Orlick's way since ever you was a child. You goes out of his way, this present night. He'll have no more on you. You're dead." I felt that I had come to the brink of my grave. For a moment I looked wildly round my trap for any chance of escape, but there was none. "More than that," said he, folding his arms on the table again, "I won't have a rag of you, I won't have a bone of you, left on earth. I'll put your body in the kiln I'd carry to such to it, on my shoulders, and, let people suppose what they may of you, they shall never know nothing." My mind, with inconceivable rapidity, followed out all the consequences of such a death. Estella's father would believe I had deserted him, would be taken, would die accusing me, Even Herbert would doubt me when he compared the letter I had left for him with the fact that I had called at Miss Havisham's gate for only a moment. Joe and Biddy would never know how sorry I had been that night. None would ever know what I had suffered, how true I had meant to be, what an agony I had passed through. The death close before me was terrible, but far more terrible than death was the dread of being misremembered after death. And so quick were my thoughts, that I saw myself despised by unborn generations as Stella's children, and their children, while the wretch's words were yet on his lips. "Now, Wolf," said he, "afore I kill you like any other beast, which is what I mean to do, and what I have tied you up for, I'll have a good look at you, and a good go at you. Oh, you enemy!" It had passed through my thoughts to cry out for help again, though few could know better than I the solitary nature of the spot and the hopelessness of aid. But as he sat gloating over me, I was supported by a scornful detestation of him that sealed my lips. Above all things, I resolved that I would not entreat him, and that I would die making some last poor resistance to him. Softened as my thoughts of all the rest of men were in that dire extremity, humbly beseeching pardon, as I did, of heaven, melted at heart, as I was, by the thought that I had taken no farewell, and never, never now could take farewell, of those who were dear to me, or could explain myself to them, or ask for their compassion on my miserable errors. Still, if I could have killed him, even in dying, I would have done it. He had been drinking, and his eyes were red and bloodshot. Around his neck was slung a tin bottle, as I had often seen his meat and drink slung about him in other days. He brought the bottle to his lips, and took a fiery drink from it, and I smelt the strong spirits that I saw flash into his face. "Wolf," said he, folding his arms again, "old Orlick's a-going to tell you something. It was you as did for your shrew sister." Again my mind, with its former inconceivable rapidity, had exhausted the whole subject of the attack upon my sister, her illness, and her death, before his slow and hesitating speech had formed these words. "It was you, villain," said one. "I tell you it was your doing, I tell you it was done through you," he retorted, catching up the gun, and making a blow with the stock at the vacant air between us. "I come upon her from behind, as I come upon you tonight. I give it her. I left her for dead, and if there had been a limicon as nigh her as there is now nigh you, she shouldn't have come to life again. But it warned old Orlick as did it. It was you. He was favored, and he was bullied and beat. Old Orlick bullied and beat, eh? Now you pays for it. You done it. Now you pays for it." He drank again, and became more ferocious. I saw by his tilting of the bottle that there was no great quantity left in it. I distinctly understood that he was working himself up with its contents to make an end of me. I knew that every drop it held was a drop of my life. I knew that when I was changed into a part of the vapor that had crept towards me but a little while before, like my own warning ghost, he would do as he had done in my sister's case, make all haste to the town, and be seen slouching about there, drinking at the alehouses. My rapid mind pursued him to the town, made a picture of the street with him in it, and contrasted its lights and life with the lonely marsh, and the white vapor creeping over it, into which I should have dissolved. It was not only that I could have summed up years and years and years, while he said a dozen words, but that what he did say presented pictures to me, and not mere words. In the excited and exalted state of my brain, I could not think of a place without seeing it, or of persons without seeing them. It is impossible to overstate the vividness of these images, and yet I was so intent, all the time, upon him himself who would not be intent on the tiger crouching to spring, that I knew of the slightest action of his fingers. When he had drunk this second time, he rose from the bench on which he sat, and pushed the table aside. Then, he took up the candle, and shading it with his murderous hand so as to throw its light on me, stood before me, looking at me, and enjoying the sight. "Wolf, I'll tell you something more. It was old Orlick as you tumbled over on your stairs that night. I saw the staircase with its extinguished lamps. I saw the shadows of the heavy stair rails, thrown by the watchman's lantern on the wall. I saw the rooms, that I was never to see again. Here, a door half open. There, a door closed. All the articles of furniture around. And why was old Orlick there? I'll tell you something more, Wolf. Elander have pretty well hunted me out of this country, so far as getting a easy living in it goes, and I've took up with new companions, and new masters. Some of 'em writes my letters, when I want some wrote do you mind? Writes my letters, Wolf. They writes 50 hands, they're not like sneaking you, as writes but one. I've had a firm mind and a firm will to have your life, since you was down here at your sister's burying. I ain't seen a way to get you safe, and I've looked arter you to know your ins and outs. For, says old Orlick to himself, somehow or another I'll have him. Apostrophe apostrophe what? When I looks for you, I finds your Uncle Provis, eh? Mill Pond Bank, and Chink's Basin, and the old green copper rope walk, all so clear and plain. Provis in his rooms, the signal whose use was over, pretty Clara, the good motherly woman, old Bill Barley on his back, all drifting by, as on the swift stream of my life fast running out to sea. You with a uncle too. Why, I knowed you at Gargery's, when you was so small a wolf, that I could have took your weasand betwixt this. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.